I wanted to deal today with wrong motives, false calls, what keeps people from the mission field. So this is basically continuing the whole issue of long-term, lifelong or short-term missions. Because of human depravity, even the best of us can do some of the finest ministry with mixed motives. In fact, even Dr. David Livingstone wrote, he was deeply concerned that even when he did some of the best of activities, it was with mixed motives, and he was not satisfied. And we would have thought, you know, who was the greater missionary? Who sacrificed more? 26 years walking across the continent of Africa, across two vast countries today, but what then was hundreds of tribes, acquiring the languages of the people, not needing to preach through interpreters, preaching to the people in their own language, acquiring their languages. He preached in Chichewa, in Tswana, in Bemba, in Swahili. Just extraordinary. And David Livingstone was self-critical that he said he is deeply concerned that there was mixed motives in him. And which of us can say there or not. But you must not wait for your motives to be 100% pure before launching out into missions, or you'll never get there. However, once in the mission field, you can expect God to thoroughly purify your motives. There's nothing like the field and sickness and dysentery and malaria and fever and interpersonal problems and roosters crowing from 2 a.m. outside your hut and all the other sort of things to sort of challenge your motives. Those who go to the mission field for predominantly wrong motives can cause a lot of grief to themselves and to those around them, including team members and those to whom we are sent to minister amongst. These are some examples of wrong reasons for involvement in missions. I'm sure there are many others, but these are some prominent ones. Number one, would you believe it? Some people go into missions as a desire to escape problems at home or work. Boredom, job dissatisfaction, in-law problems, and so on. But escaping to the mission field doesn't work because you take your biggest problem with you. Because our biggest enemy is ourselves. No one causes us more grief than ourselves. I am my own worst enemy. Examples. When Martin Luther, the great professor and reformer, was asked, which was the worst pope you live under? Now, he ministered during the reigns of 10 popes. He saw a lot of popes come and go. He said, the worst was Pope Self, the pope that sits on the throne of my heart. He says, he caused me more grief than all the popes in Rome. They once asked Spurgeon, Charles Spurgeon, the Prince of Preachers, Baptist Tabernacle, which member of the Baptist Tabernacle caused you the most trouble? Now, he had 5,600 members. He said, Charles Spurgeon. They said, do you have a member here called Charles Spurgeon? He said, I refer to myself. He said, no member of this church has given me more grief than I have. I am my own worst enemy. Now, those people are brutally honest. Most of us might not have thought of that. But actually, it's true. A lot of people, I have to leave this church because of this, this, and this problem. I've got to leave home because of the problems at home with my siblings and so on. I have to leave this or that mission because of these and these. But they take the problems with them because actually they're the problem. I need to change myself more than my circumstances or my location. God's will is not primarily about your location or your vocation or who you marry and so on. The most important as those are, the most important thing is myself, which is why discipleship and sanctification is so vital. Number two, the desire to impress other people. There are missionary children who often feel obligated to follow in their parents' footsteps or grandparents' footsteps. Fear of disappointing college teachers, pastor, or church friends. That's not a good reason to go to the field. To impress other people or to fulfill other people's expectations. Bad, bad motive. We shouldn't be going there to impress anyone except to be grateful to God. A desire to be more holy and dedicated than one's peers. This is seriously a problem. The amount of people who come along with this idea that I want to be more holy than dedicated. I remember people saying to me, we've actually had people in the mission say things like, I'm more holy than you are. Sorry, I'm more humble than you are. And gee, you know, if you gave someone a medal for humility, you'd have to take it away if he wore it. And this is a serious problem, that there's often a desire to be more holy or more dedicated than others. But this is, again, people-pleasing. This is trying to impress other people. That is not a good reason for missions, ever. God's will is far more important than what people think of it. And by the way, God's will often doesn't get the cheers and applause of people because a lot of people criticize you. You're not the right person. This isn't the right time. That's not the right field. This isn't the right way of doing it. And so on. Three, the desire to prove something to yourself. The mission field is not the place to go for an ego trip. And I'm afraid in the days of selfies and all that, this has gotten a little carried away. Fourthly, there's often a desire to earn favor with God. Salvation by works mentality. In the Roman Catholic world, if you're really serious for God, you're going to become a nun, a monk, a brother, priest, that sort of thing. You know, that kind of attitude. And so that's a salvation by works idea. And we Protestants have our own version of it, where some people think, you know, if I suffer enough for God, then he'll be pleased with me. No, we do our work out of gratitude to God, not to earn favor with him. It's by grace alone, by faith. Then there are people who go the field because of feelings of guilt and pity for being better off than the downtrodden masses who've been exploited and oppressed. And, oh my, is guilt manipulation alive and well? We've got an excellent book on the shelves called Productive Christians in the Age of Guilt Manipulators by David Chilton. One of the best books I've ever read. Absolutely outstanding. So you've got to go to the field for better reasons than politics of guilt and pity. Then there's emotionalism. Human emotions are God-given and essential, but emotion is not a good enough basis for call. Remember what Proverbs says? Only a fool trusts his own heart. Unfortunately, most people... Now, in the Bible, the heart often means the center of your being. But today, heart often is interpreted to mean my feelings. It's not the biblical concept. The biblical concept is far more the center core of your being, which includes your will and emotions and so on. But the trouble is today, most people following Disney's follow your heart mantra feel like they've got to follow the things. I feel like doing this. I don't feel like doing this. And then some people put a Christianese spin on it saying, I don't have peace about that. I don't have peace about going on the streets witnessing. I feel uneasy. What they should be saying is, I'm a coward and I don't want to go out of my comfort zone. You know, but they can put a spiritual spin on it. You know, I don't have peace about that. I'll have to pray about that, which they probably don't. I mean, they're probably lying right there. The amount of people who, you know, you invite them to an outreach and I've got to pray about that. And funny enough, God never leads them to obey the Great Commission. So, you know, somehow, but it's nice to put the blame off on God. The amount of times I've heard people saying, when I was young, I told God I'd go anywhere, do anything, but he never called me. I find it frankly incredible, in the real sense of the word, incredible, unbelievable. Oh, so you were ready, prepared, your motives were as pure as the driven snow, you're 100% sold out, just God dropped the ball and missed the opportunity of getting you to obey his great commission. It's already given. I don't believe it. Frankly, I think those people are bearing false witness and blaspheming at the same time, by putting the blame on God for their inactive and unproductive life. So what is holding you back? Are you in debt? You must pay it off. You cannot go into the mission field in debt. Take, for example, my wife, Lenora, well, before she became my wife, she had to sell her car and a whole lot of other things in order to pay off her college debt, so that she could come to the field and join our mission. We didn't tell her that. That's something that her church told her that was essential. And that's certainly a good principle. You can't expect people to be supporting someone to pay off their college debt. You could expect people to be supporting you in a mission field, but it's not reasonable to expect people to take dedicated, consecrated church money, tithes and offerings and so on, to pay off one's college debt. One's college debt needs to get paid off. Now, I was in the mission field. I was in Mozambique. I was already full-time involved in missions. And God convicted me that I actually had a debt. I thought I had no debts, but I actually did. I realized when I was at Hospital Christian Fellowship, my first mission, I'd frequently used the phone without permission. I had a girlfriend in Cape Town. I regularly phoned. Boy, who knows how many hundreds of rands I ran up on the mission tab. And when hundreds of rands was a lot of money. On long phone calls back home to my sweetheart. I mean, honestly. And the conviction came on me so much. I left the mission field, came back, asked my dad for a job at the Newlands Cricket Grounds and worked at the Newlands Cricket Grounds through the summer in order to get enough money to send a massive donation through to Hospital Christian Fellowship to pay off what I estimated to be my phone bill double because, you know, restitution, because I understood it to be theft. That most of us would never dream of stealing money from someone, but we happily run up phone bills and things like this at work, and that's wrong. For example, just inside, well, let me not go there. This is enough. If you're in debt, pay it off. Number two, are you getting too much education? It needs to be remembered that one of the greatest reformers of all time, John Calvin, when he was 26, when he was already a master and doctorate in divinity and classics, when he is the author of one of the greatest best-selling books in the history of the church, the Institutes of the Christian Religion, he was asked by William Farrell, the great reformer who had just won Geneva to Christ, if he would please come to be the pastor, because William Farrell was a great evangelist, a great debater. He won whole cities to Christ, but he knew his limitations. He wasn't a pastor. And he had read the Institutes, and he knew John Calvin, this man is a student, this man's a theologian, he understands the scripture. No one has spoken up for the Protestant cause in French as effectively as him. So for French-speaking Geneva, John Calvin, will you be the pastor? And John Calvin, no, his plans were more study. And I mean, honestly, he's already got his bachelor's, master's and doctorate. What more does he need? And William Farrell, a big man, double age of Calvin at that time, stood up and thundered, "May God curse your studies if now, in an hour of need, you refuse to help Christ's church." And John Calvin testified, the terror of God came upon him as he realized that he was in rebellion, seeking too much education. He said, "I wanted, being naturally quiet and reserved, I was looking for a life of literary ease and the life of a scholar in the library and the study." He didn't want the confrontation and conflict that went along with being a pastor of a newly converted city in what used to be a Catholic world. But he submitted to God's will, and John Calvin blessed the church phenomenally with his writings and his example. And during his lifetime, he trained 2,000 missionaries in the Geneva Academy and sent them out, and they planted over 1,000 churches just in France in his lifetime. And he sent missionaries as far afield as Brazil and Iceland and Finland and Russia and Poland. Phenomenal achievements that John Calvin did as a second generation missionary reformer. Luther Zwingli were the first generation. John Calvin was part of the second generation of reformers. Are you getting too much education? My own son-in-law, Hunter, who you know is a real academic, he did his bachelor's, magna summa cum laude, best in the college and in theology, but he needed his master's. He got that magna summa cum laude, I mean, with honors. And then he is thinking of his doctorate, and I, at this point, look, I know you're an academic, as is my daughter Andrea, but honestly, you don't need any more now. You can get around to your doctorate at a later stage. Get in the field, you need it now. And it was, to Hunter's credit, that although his natural inclination, like John Calvin's, more study, more study, more education, he realized, no, it's time for me to get in the field. Number three, are you falling in love with someone who's not committed to missions? Now, the day I was converted to Christ, the 3rd of April 1977, I was called to missions. I came from a secular family, no Bible reading, no prayer, no church service, no Sunday school in my family. I was brought up by secular parents. And when I was converted on the 3rd of April 1977, I knew I was called to missions, which is strange because I didn't know a single missionary. I'd never heard of any missionary. The only missionary I knew of was David Livingstone. And at that stage, I didn't even know he was a missionary. I just knew him as an explorer. And yet I knew. And for the last 42 years, I have not doubted for a moment that I'm called to lifelong missions. Great commission, my supreme ambition. And you can imagine my parents were furious. You're going to waste your life. I turned down 3 scholarship options that year. I had 2 options for Stellenbosch, one to be a trained for being a teacher at UCT, I turned them down, hitchhiked up to Kempton Park, joined Hospital Christian Fellowship, and soon I was doing all these other crazy things. And so my parents were just beyond furious. You know, when are you going to stop wasting your life? I heard from my parents many a time. Well, as time went on, I met the girl of my dreams. She was everything that I could have ever imagined. And we got engaged. I mean, she was daughter of missionary parents. Her parents had been missionaries in the Gilbert Islands. She was brought up in the Gilbert Islands of the Pacific. She's a wonderful artist. She is just my kind of person every way. And also same background as me in the sense of her father's English and mother's German. And we just clicked. And it was absolutely, I didn't doubt in any sense that she was the girl for me. And in fact, my parents, her parents, everyone was happy. Everyone thought we were a match made in heaven. But as soon as we got engaged, she started putting serious pressure on me to abandon my ideas for missions and to go, and I was just finishing off my Baptist Theological College at that time, and to enter the pastorate. Now, her dad ran a denomination, and he was offering me a really nice pastorate in a very prestigious place. Nice suburb, lovely home, man's two cars, you know, all sorts of things. You can still go on missions once a year, you know, maybe on holidays or something. And I had to make a serious decision. Now, we're still friends. My wife and her are friends. My children are friends with her children. You know, she's not my enemy. But we could not. We had incompatible life careers. And it's not that I didn't like her anymore. It's just that she was not committed to missions. She did not want to go into missions. She knew what missions was. Her parents had been there. She'd been in the field. She was not interested. And it broke my heart for several years, but I turned my back on this match made in heaven, my idea, and trusted that God might have someone else. And well, as you would have heard yesterday, my wife is born of missionaries, brought up in the field, been with her dad smuggling Bibles in Eastern Europe since she was four, been baptized in Eastern Europe and Romania amongst the persecuted church. And Lenora has joined me for missions behind Iron Curtain. In fact, on our honeymoon, we were smuggling Bibles into Eastern Europe. Her parents in one car, we were in the other, and we were going into everywhere from Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Hungary, Romania, and so on. And it took longer. I actually got married. So I got engaged at age 25, and I actually got married finally to, of course, Lenora, not Anne, at age 29. But older than one probably should be. But these days, 10 people tend to get married older than in the past. My daughter didn't hesitate for a moment. She got married at age, was she 19? She was just 20, yeah. So she got married at 20, and so they started early. But you can see they're both equally committed to missions. And of course, in Andre and Hunter, you've got third-generation missionaries. I'm a first-generation missionary. They're third-generation. Because their grandparents, parents, you know, all the way through. So if Jeremy or Joshua go into it, they'd be fourth-generation missionaries. Are your parents opposed to your going? Now, this doesn't necessarily have to be a no-no, because if you have finished your education, if you're over 18, if you've left home, if you're self-supporting, you don't have to obey your parents on this matter, but you do have to honor them. So, for example, my parents were blood-red furious at me being involved in missions. They were very opposed. But you've got to obey God rather than man. Now, I still honored my parents, loved my parents, and I was trying to work for their conversion. But even though they thought you're wasting your life, how could you turn down three bursaries and things like this? Nevertheless, are your parents opposed to your going? And it's not just non-Christian parents. You get Christian parents, dedicated Christian parents, opposed to their children going to missions for different reasons too. Are you worried about your safety? And that is a legitimate concern. I heard it said many years ago, and I've repeated it to many of our teams many a time. Do not take anything into the mission field that you're not willing to lose. That includes your own life. If you are not willing to die for Christ and lose everything you've got, don't even go. I mean, sad to say, but that's reality. It is risky, especially if you work into restricted access areas. Of course, there's safer areas for missions, but to be honest, I don't know if there's anywhere in the world now that's totally safe. There's risks in life everywhere, traffic accidents, crime, and so on. But of course, the danger increases exponentially when you get into some mission fields, more chances of the diseases and all the rest. All of our missionaries in frontline have had malaria. We've all had dysentery. Some have even had hepatitis and other weird and wonderful other things, black water fever, you name it. There's just a plethora of unpronounceable, unspellable diseases waiting out there if you're not careful. So are you worried about your safety? That could be a deal breaker for some. Are you afraid of failing? Many people are afraid of going into missions because they're afraid of failing. Failing to learn a language, failing in the field, failing to raise support. There's a lot of things people are afraid of. Are you afraid of dirt, disease, and discomfort? By the way, this is 2011. You recognize Daniel in there. And yes, that was part of Newlands Forest. This is back in July 2011. GCC, when we used to do winter GCCs, it was a lot colder, a lot wetter, and we would be going through the rivers up to our chest high sometimes. And if you're afraid of dirt, disease, and discomfort, mission field might not be for you. I'm actually a germaphobe. I hate dirt. I like to have a clean pillowcase. I like clean water. I like to be clean. But tea in the field, just got to get used to it. I've slept in the sand. I've slept in the dirt. I've slept in absolute filth in prison cells and so on. And, you know, God's grace is greater. Are you afraid about and worried about your children? Well, to be honest, I'd be more afraid of my children growing up in the decadence of Western civilization and so on, than in the field in a missionary situation. And so, yes, there are concerns about your children, but just take, for example, my wife, brought up in Austria. She loves Austria, of course. As she said, she thinks mission field should be alpine. Hates cockroaches and spiders and things like that. Says Cape Town's Africa enough for her. But to Lenora, she says, I'd never want to bring up my children in Europe. So godlessly. She praises God that she's been able to bring up her children in South Africa and Cape Town. Strong Christians, strong churches, strong fellowship. There's a lot of serious Christians in South Africa. This is a good place to raise your children. And here's Calvin at age 8 sharing the gospel presentation, Ten Commandments, Apostles' Creed, Lord's Prayer and so on before school children in Kabwe. The greatest hindrance to missionary work is self. Self that refuses to sacrifice. Self that refuses to give. Self that refuses to go. God's word comes to us, go ye therefore. So why do many resist the call to missions? First of all, there's the myth of the super spiritual missionary. There's this unrealistic expectation of the spiritual qualifications required. I mean, a person says, I'm not a super spiritual saint. Well, no, neither is any missionary. Missionaries are ordinary Christians who face the same struggles and infirmities as other Christians. We get sick, we get injured, we get hurt, we misunderstand, we sin, and we are sinned against. But they are responding to the Great Commission. So forget the myth of the super spiritual missionary thinking, you know, I don't think I could be a Mary Sless or David Livingstone. Well, they had their expectations of great missionaries as well, which they thought there's no way I can match up that either. I mean, it's a myth. Simple. There's the burden of deputation. Hard work of promoting missions, recruiting prayer supporters, inspiring others into missions, getting your home church involved. It's essential, but it's daunting. And of course, if you prefer your comfort zone, if you don't like confrontation or stepping out, then you're naturally going to shrink from it and not get the prayer support base to get the church to thrust you out. The first time I went forward to my church, God's called me to missions. All I've got is, you're too young. You haven't got any education. What do you know? When I came back from the army, I'd already been in hospital Christian fellowship, had this vision for missions to Mozambique, frontline states and all that. This isn't the right time. It's illegal. It's too dangerous. My church leaders were giving every reason why I shouldn't go, actually. Fortunately, I had a pastor who was supportive, Doc Watson, which made a big difference. There's a reluctance to make a lifelong commitment. The most efficient expenditure of resources is career commitment, lifelong missions. Yet the existentialism of the now generation militates against long-term commitment. Now, what do I mean by existentialism? Existentialism is the primary secular humanist worldview at work today. Me, myself, and I, my personal experience now. That's existentialism. That's the theme of most Hollywood movies and everything. The only thing that really matters is me, my own personal experiences, wants, desires, and needs now. Forget the future, forget the past, forget other people. I, me, myself, that's a new trinity of secular humanism. And the now generation, they think a long-term commitment is a three-week course. You know, whereas long-term commitment, it used to be 4 years for the average duration of a mission in the field, before furlough. And today, we need to be committed for life. Take Bill Bathman. At age 67, he is still preaching gospel, and he's still able and still going on missions, and he's still able, sorry, not age 67, after 67 years in the field, at age 88, he was still able to get banned from pulpits for giving altar calls and preaching to the congregation like there were sinners who need to repent. Can you imagine? I mean, audacity. Bill Bathman went to 114 countries of the world for the gospel. All the major communist countries, most of the minor ones, all throughout Eastern Europe, Russia, and so on. He went to the toughest fields, and here at the battlefront in Sudan, at the hospital of Samaritan's Purse. Well, if a Caleb in his 80s can say, give me that mountain, you know, what excuse do we have? Fourth, there's the reticence to learn another language. The negative experience of many in foreign language class at school might discourage them from attempting to learn how to communicate the gospel in the field through a foreign language. But, you know, there's many mission fields where you can go and speak English. There's many mission fields where French will get you everywhere you need to go. 21 countries in Africa to start with. One of the biggest countries in Africa, for example, Congo, French is the main language, right? So, you can go a long way on Portuguese. 5 countries in Africa have Portuguese. Now, these are European languages, which many people already know. Major mission fields, very effective. Now, if you, for example, feel called to a Muslim Arab country, there's 7 countries North Africa speak Arabic. Instead of learning Arabic in Cape Town, which would be an absolute nightmare pain, to be honest, why not go and study Arabic in the university in Cairo? Then you're in the field. You can be in fellowship of a local Coptic church during the week as well. And you'll be learning the language in the mission field, and the people will be seeing your sacrifice as you acquire language skills. Why not learn the language in the field where you're going to use it, instead of just, you know, learning it theoretically, and then you get there and you find, oh, they pronounce it different, and you've learned a different type of Arabic to what they speak in that particular country anyway. So language acquisition is actually not that bad when you're learning it in the field in the situation where you need it. Language learning while communicating the gospel is a far more enjoyable and workable experience than just academically amongst people who don't speak the language. Number 5, the fear of failure. I already mentioned this. Many fear that they might fail to raise enough support, fail to adjust to the new culture, fail to learn the new language. The fear of a tough, demanding, dangerous, or difficult job in unfamiliar surroundings obviously would daunt most people. I mean, you need faith, you need perseverance, you need a bit of adventurous spirit for this. The fear of the unknown deters many people from launching out in obedience and faith, but nothing ventured, nothing gained. And I could just think of the myriad of fears. Do you know, when I started this work in 1982, to most South Africans, almost everyone, South Africans could not go on missions to Africa. Like, just, are you out of your mind? We were at war with Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Zambia, and Angola. That was the reality in 1980s. They were sending terrorists to us. We were sending raids to them. They were bombing us. We were bombing them. I mean, we were at war with these countries. Just like the whole of Africa hated South Africa, apartheid South Africa at that time. So it seemed insane. And everyone from our family to my church thought, are you out of your mind? Do you have a death wish? What on earth are you thinking? Why would you go there to... Why don't you go to South America or something? Well, Carson called me South America. And I was convinced, and I still am convinced, I'm called to Africa. And funnily enough, when I got married to Laura, 1989, 30 years ago. I meet there a whole lot of people, including my own brother, asking, when am I moving to America? I'm not moving to America. Brother chewed glass and crawled across a minefield and while being bombed by Arabs and moved to America. Are you out of your mind? Well, I thought that's why you married Laura. No, there were other things in my mind. I had absolutely no thought of getting a green card moving to America. I'm not interested in American citizenship. I'm not an American. I'm an African. Born and bred. I couldn't imagine a circumstance in which I would leave Africa and not have Africa as my primary home and field. It's just beyond comprehension to me why anyone would want to go to boring countries where they don't even have predators like cheetahs and lions and leopards and elephants and giraffes and rhinos. And, you know, honestly, we are in the best continent. And I don't know why anyone would put up with something as boring as Australia, for example. Well, shame. The poor people over there, as my Australian missionary friend I've done years of work with, Rob left Australia when he was 18. He's now in the 70s. He's been fighting foreign wars everywhere and was serving our mission for several years and ended up in jail with me, prison with me in Zambia. Rob says, about the most deadly thing that can happen to you in Australia is a beer goes flat. He said, it's boring as hell. He said, no, he said he couldn't live there at all. He said, it's bad enough to have to go back to visit family. So why many are who respond to the call are sidetracked? They're people who, from my earliest experience, I remember as a new Christian, being in meetings and conferences and camps and so on, where who feels called to missions or who wants to commit themselves to missions? And you see vast amounts of these young people standing up. And I knew them. And virtually none of them ended up in the field. I remembered many a time being part of a whole group of us coming forward and making commitments to missions. There's a lot of pressure and pushing for this in the 70s and 80s. Bless the Nations conferences, boy, those all over the country. The Student Consultation Frontier Missions Conference in Rustburg 1982, many, many, and I know many of those people never went to field. So why do so many who say they're called get sidetracked? Love and marriage, number one. Many prospective missionaries get sidetracked by marrying someone who's not willing to be a missionary, who have many ways of conniving, manipulating, and ensuring that they get sidetracked. Number two, parental opposition. The tension between honoring our parents and obeying the Lord. Many people choose to rather obey their parents on this, even after they've grown up, left home, self-sufficient, all this, and yet they still don't want to disappoint their parents who say no. Number three, financial debt. Good intentions crippled by unwise choices and enslaving debt. In America, I'm told that the average person who gets a college education takes more than 20 years to pay it off. In South Africa, it's not far behind that. It's pretty bad. It's extremely expensive. And, I mean, some people are getting degrees in gender studies and political science and other unworkable, worthless degrees that aren't going to help you one bit. You know, why don't they get a trade? And then I do carpentry, plumbing, electricity, mechanics. I mean, there's so many practical things that really help in the field, and yet there's people getting these mindless degrees, which some, you know, feminist studies. Oh, gee, that's really going to help one get a job. And just on a hilarious note there, one of our best missionaries that we had, Martha McComb, I met her when she was very, very young, back in my first mission to America in 1988. I was in a mission meeting in Texas, and this young girl, gee, she looks so young, she could have been in high school for all I knew. She came pounding up to me, I want to be a missionary in Africa. I looked fairly unimpressed, and I said, what experience or training do you have? She says, I've got a political science degree. I said, well, that's not going to help in the field, is it? I said, look, why don't you go to Bible college? Get involved in the pro-life movement. Get yourself arrested rescuing babies. Do some evangelism in the city. Then contact us. And do you know, 3 years later, she wrote to me, I've done everything you said. I've been arrested twice for pro-life rescues. I've finished twice for the Nations Bible College and been involved in evangelism and inner city work. Come right over. Well, she is outstanding. She is really, really good. And she went after 4 years with us up to Europe to be a missionary in Serbia, where she got bombed by her own air force. while praying in church in Serbia, and the American Air Force came and bombed them for that wag the dog war to distract attention from Bill Clinton's scandals. So they just decided to bomb some other country, including their own missionaries. And she later became the head of Youth with a Mission, YWAM's operations in the whole of Eastern Europe. Now she's a missionary in Jordan, married and ministering in Jordan. And all started with me making an offhand, kind of rude comment about her worthless degree and telling her what she had to do to get ready for missions. But she took me seriously and she actually did it. And she became an absolutely superb, outstanding missionary. She also was somebody who had still debt to college and said, you got it paid off? And she did before she came to field. Okay, these are some of the ways that people get sidetracked, but Christ must come first. Our vision is Africa for Christ. Now, of course, a mission worker's training should not stop when they reach a field. In fact, it must never stop. It takes an average of 3 years or more for any trainee field worker in Frontline Fellowship to qualify as a field worker. Our training includes courses like Great Commission Course, the South Shore Training Course, Biblical Worldview Seminar, Muslim Evangelism Workshops, Evangelism Explosion 3, First Aid Courses, Participation in Many Outreaches, Street Evangelism, Muslim Evangelism, Bible Smuggling into Restricted Access Countries. There are required reading lists, written assignments, practical tests, and all of these are important components of a comprehensive program to prepare effective missionaries for ministry in war-torn Muslim or communist countries. I think Frontline selection training procedure is fairly unique because we have a blend of intensive biblical instruction and practical outreach within an apprenticeship program. I was blessed to be apprenticed by Francis Grimm, a South African missionary planted hospital Christian fellowship in 100 countries in the world, and then to be apprenticed under other great missionaries, people like Erla Stegen, across the Bantu Mission, Reverend Bill Bathman, who founded Pioneers Network and In Touch Mission, to have an outstanding German missionary, Professor Fritz Haus, as my mentor at Theology College. He's our Old Testament professor, and he was heavily involved on our board of our mission and helping us develop our Reformation work as well. So I believe apprenticeship is the biblical model. Elisha studying under Elijah, Joshua studying under Moses, the 12 apostles under Jesus, Timothy under Paul, and so on. So those who are easily upset by irritations and loss of sleep or unfair treatment, those who are moody and easily discouraged and depressed, are not suitable for missions. Missionaries must be emotionally stable and self-disciplined. And by the way, we can change our character. I was such an introvert loner, I never said a word. Someone was asking me, Daniel was asking me last night about birthday parties while I was growing up. I never had a birthday celebration while I was growing up because I didn't have any friends. I never missed them. I'm not being sorry for myself. My brother had friends, he had parties. My parents were life and soul of the party. I was the quiet introvert playing with animals, going to the library, and doing all my schoolwork and homework and being a very diligent bookworm. I was super quiet and introverted and moody and often depressed. I used to be able to go into deep, dark, black depression for weeks. And now most people see me as nothing but an optimist and super positive, and I don't think I've been depressed in 40 years. And the difference is God's changed my character. So the fact that we might have been emotionally unstable and depressive before doesn't mean we have to stay that way. Certainly I've found that. In the mission field, relationship difficulties are aggravated by high levels of stress, heat, cross-cultural frustration. The closeness of living and traveling and working conditions intensifies personal conflicts. Missionaries tend to be strong-willed people. You might have picked it up. So potential clashes can undermine the mission team project because you've got a bunch of strong-willed people banging heads against one another. You get conflict in missions. I mean, it happens. Just think, the first mission team ever, Paul and Barnabas, split. Yeah, that does happen. There are two major problems here. Dependent people who need constant support and direction and sap the energy from a team. And then there's independent people who divert the team's energy as they pull one way or the other, pursuing their own agendas. You know, so you've got the Lone Ranger and Rambo sort of thing. But missionaries need to be interdependent, team players, relinquishing their own interests for the good of the team, which is why we've had team building exercises and so on. We've got to be self-starters, self-reliant and self-sacrificing, but not selfish. The harsh terrains, the hot climates, the primitive conditions of motion mission fields require healthy, fit missionaries who can endure and be effective in adverse conditions, who can cope with and recover from debilitating sickness. You will get sick. The healthier and fitter you are, and the better you eat and the more you exercise, the quicker you'll recover. It's amazing how many people volunteer for missions who've never done any ministry at home. You know, if it doesn't work at home, don't export it. And so the first thing I tell anyone who wants to get involved in missions, what have you done in your local church? If you're not going to be missed, then don't go. Make yourself absolutely invaluable in your local church. Offer your service to your pastor. Do everything that the local church needs. Be the most faithful member in your local church. When you go into the field, you should be missed. And that was the case for the first mission team. The church in Antioch sent out Barnabas and Paul, two of the very best. And that's where it should be. It shouldn't be, you know, I don't know what else to do, so again. No, it's got to be, you've done lots of work, Sunday school, street evangelism, door to door, you've done all the work you can do locally. Before you think of going, unless you've worked in Jerusalem, don't bother going to Judea, Samaria, and utmost parts. It's essential for all missionaries to have extensive ministry experience at home before venturing into cross-cultural missions overseas. If it does not work at home, it is not exportable. Obstacles abound. Frustrations, disappointments, and discouragements are occupational hazards and part of your job description. Missionaries need endurance, a willingness and a capacity to suffer hardships, discomfort, opposition, and worse. Sacrificial service is more eloquent than many sermons. Ultimately, it doesn't matter what you say if it doesn't match up with what you do. For whoever calls the name of the Lord shall be saved. How then shall they call on him in whom they've not believed? How shall they believe in him of whom they've not heard? How shall they hear without a preacher? How shall they preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the gospel of peace, who bring glad tidings of good things. Now, that's from Romans 10, but the picture I've chosen is of the evangelist in the Nub Mountains without feet. The Arabs chopped his feet off because he's an evangelist. But it did not deter him. It did not stop him. Despite the inconvenience of having no feet, he's continued to preach the gospel, riding on donkey or walking on his knees. And so when I look at this picture, I think, what excuse do the rest of us have? We know all of you have feet, because we just mentioned Climb Table Mountain. But how beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who preach good news. May your ways be known on earth, your salvation amongst all nations. May the peoples praise you, God. May all the peoples praise you.